You're listening to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. The Taliban takeover of Afghanistan has been nothing short of a disaster and tragedy for the people of Afghanistan and the United States. America's longest war ended after 20 years when the Taliban reclaimed what it lost when the U.S. sought to drive the extremist out of power for harboring al-Qaeda, the terrorist group behind the September 11, 2001 attacks on New York, Washington, and hijacking of a plane that crashed in western Pennsylvania. 2,200 Americans lost their lives in the war, and another 20,000 were wounded. Tens of thousands of Afghans were killed, and many are in danger now for helping the United States. Women and girls are especially vulnerable right now. Politicians are pointing fingers at who is to blame. But what happened? We're fortunate to have an expert on the region and the history with us today. Joining us is Dr. Chris Mason, Professor of National Security Affairs at the Strategic Studies Institute at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle. Dr. Mason, welcome to the program. I'll ask for the synopsis version, and then we can talk more in depth. But what went wrong? What happened?
Good morning, Scott. First of all, I have to give the standard disclaimer that my views this morning, of course, are my own personal views and do not represent the policy positions of either the U.S. Army or the Department of Defense. And thank you for having me on today to talk through some of these things. I think the first thing that we have to make clear is that this was always going to happen. The way that it unfolded in recent days was unfortunate, but the Taliban were always going to come back to power because of flaws built into the Afghan government 20 years ago during what was called the bond process after the U.S. And its allies in northern Afghanistan removed the Taliban from power in November of 2001.
What is the Taliban, by the way? This is a basic question, but I've heard a few people ask. What is the Taliban? It's a militia group, right?
It's a religious order. One analogy that I've heard that makes a kind of a sense in some ways is that it's similar in a way to the medieval. Students, warriors, priests, and so on, but were dedicated to a religious cause.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is kind of a long question, Dr. Mason, but bear with me here for just a moment. President Biden has taken a lot of heat, and it came on his watch. So his administration did fail in some ways, and we'll talk about those, with not preparing for withdrawal of Americans and Afghans who helped Americans. But let's look back a few years, back to 20 years. President George W. Bush's decision to invade Iraq took resources, personnel, and money from the war in Afghanistan. President Obama wanted out, but Iraq was a priority for him, and from what we understand now, didn't listen to military advisors, said fewer but better Afghan security forces would be more effective. In other words, he chose quantity over quality. President Trump made a deal with the Taliban and wanted troops out in May. Actually, he had to be talked out of taking them out immediately, even before that. And this deal is that the Trump administration made is what the Biden administration followed. And, of course, President Biden's intelligence failures and failure to prepare sealed the deal. Were all those things I just listed all factors in this?
I think some of them were. I personally do not subscribe to the narrative that we took our eyes off the ball when we went to Iraq. I think the failure in Afghanistan is located in Afghanistan. And I don't think any amount of U.S. effort any amount of U.S. troops were going to change the dynamics there. It's just beyond the power of one country to fundamentally change the society and culture of another country. I think we should have learned that lesson in Vietnam. And honestly, yes, I think mistakes were made in the way this withdrawal was executed. But I think blaming President Biden for the fall of Afghanistan is like blaming President Gerald Ford for the fall of South Vietnam. I think he was just there at the end.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, when you're talking about looking back 20 years, and I mean, in basically what you're saying is that the United States went in without knowing the culture, without bothering to learn the culture, maybe learn some lessons along the way. But why wasn't it recognized 20 years ago, 15 years ago, 10 years ago, that this wasn't working, that that there was a problem, and that nation building was not something we could do in Afghanistan?
Well, you know, that's the $64,000 question, or the $64 million question. There were people who recognized that, and there were dissenting voices, mine among them, who said that this kind of central, strong central authority in Afghanistan, historically, politically, socially, was not going to work. I think unfortunate decisions were made very early on in the process. I've argued that the Afghan monarchy, the king, could have played a ceremonial role as a figure of national unity, kind of like the Queen of England or the Emperor of Japan, and perhaps provided some legitimacy for what the UN was trying to do in Afghanistan politically. The problem, I think, basically boils down to the fact that the government in Afghanistan over the last 20 years has just never achieved any kind of legitimacy with its own people. The king might have, as a sort of a national figure, a beloved national figure like the Queen of England, could have provided some of that legitimacy for what the UN was trying to accomplish. I think it was unfortunate that he was made to step down. But the Taliban, in a way, as a force that has some religious legitimacy among the people, sort of filled the vacuum, if you will, of legitimacy of governance that we didn't achieve in Vietnam, we didn't achieve in Iraq, and we didn't achieve in Afghanistan.
So did the people of Afghanistan view the Afghan government as puppets of the United States and look at the American army and its allies as occupiers?
I think many did, yes. I think that was also true in Vietnam. And I think that's a conundrum for any country that goes to the aid of another country experiencing this kind of internal conflict or civil war. There's always the easy narrative that the rebel group can hang around the neck of the government, that they're just puppets of some foreign power. The North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong made that point over and over again about the Americans in South Vietnam, that the South Vietnamese government was just a puppet of the United States. And I mean, that's an easy target to pin on someone from a propaganda standpoint.
Hmm. Let's take a phone call from Bill in Lancaster. Bill, you're on Smart Talk.
Hi, good morning, Scott.
Morning.
I agree with everything that the gentleman has said, and I'd like to add a couple of things. The first thing is, one thing that I remember from training many, many years ago is that in a conflict, you cannot hope to win a politician's war. When the politicians are calling the shots, you are bound to lose, and a stalemate is the best thing you could hope for. The second thing is, our politicians have done a great job of feathering their own nests and interests without having any understanding of the past. And Afghanistan has been a quagmire for 1,500 years or more, and it's not going to be anything else. It's a civil war, and unless the people are 100% four square behind you, and their military is with them, and their leaders are not corrupt, you're lost. And we have been doomed to lose after we missed the initial objective or pursued the initial objective of getting off bin Laden.
Bill, thank you very much for your call. Dr. Mason, what do you think?
I think that the gentleman is spot on. I think the countries that are not nations in the sense of the people having a unified national identity are prone to this kind of internal conflict. The United States, we often forget as Americans, is almost unique around the world in being a melting pot of people from many countries and many languages. And we've come together as a nation and we work together as a people. I think despite our political differences, but most countries around the world are not like that. In most countries around the world, ethnic differences, language differences, religious differences are often dividing lines that fracture society in ways that make it very difficult to build a government that satisfies everyone. And Afghanistan is one of the most fractured, divisive countries on earth. There are more languages spoken in Afghanistan, more first languages spoken, than there are in all of Europe. And we saw how long it took Europe to come together as a kind of a peaceful entity politically after the terrible wars of the 20th century.
One of the points that Bill made as well, learning from history. And now he used the figure of 1,500 years, I don't know whether that's an exaggeration or an estimate or whatever, but he is correct in that Afghanistan has been a place where war has just been commonplace, and it has gone on for hundreds of years. The Soviet Union found that out in the late 70s and early 80s. People, conquerors in medieval times found out. So did we learn from history? And I mean, obviously, at the War College, that's something that is taught. Now, I'm not laying this on, the War College, but still, I'm just saying that history is. Did we learn anything from it?
Honestly, I don't think we did. I know the Bush administration frequently said in meetings and in conversations. History starts today. History begins with us. They were pointedly not interested in the history of Afghanistan or the history of Iraq. They had a political agenda, and they were going to try to push it through. I think the idea, the neocon idea that we were going to create some sort of a liberal democracy in Iraq and in Afghanistan was a fantasy, and it was a mistake to go down that road in both countries.
Dr. Mason, let's look at a few factors that have been mentioned over the last few days. One that has been put out there from a military standpoint is that the United States tried to train the Afghan security forces as a Western fighting force when they were fighting the Taliban, which basically were guerrilla fighters, and that to be more effective, the Afghan security forces should have been trained or fought as guerrillas themselves. Your thoughts on that?
I think mistakes were made right from the beginning. And standing up the National Army. I participated in the first meetings in the U.S. government in November of 2001 about how the Afghan National Army should be structured. And I think it was a mistake to try to create the Afghan National Army as a sort of a mini-me of the U.S. Army, as we tried to do it in South Vietnam, for example. The Afghan way of organizing military forces is more locally based, much as the U.S. Army fought in state regiments from the time of our earliest militias before the American Revolution, right up until World War I. The U.S. military was organized into, the Maryland Regiment and the Massachusetts Regiment and the Maine Regiment, because boys from those states wanted to fight with other young men who they knew and trusted. And that was the way Afghanistan organized its military forces. Boys from Herat wanted to serve in Herat, and boys from Jalalabad wanted to serve with other young men from Jalalabad, people of their tribe and their own language group. And it was a mistake, I think, to try to create a national army in which, people from all over the country were all mixed together, speaking this polyglot of languages with other men who they didn't particularly know or trust. As a result of that, the annual desertion rate, the annual attrition rate from the Afghan National Army was never less than one third of the entire force every year for 18 years.
That's amazing. Huh. In your opinion, why do you think the Afghan security forces just here in the last 2 weeks when the Taliban started taking provincial capital after provincial capital, why didn't they fight? Why did they give up?
Well, part of it is the Afghan way of war. What happened is what I've written about many times, the Afghan snowball effect. Once the snowball starts rolling down the mountain in Afghanistan, it just picks up more and more snow until it turns into an avalanche. And that's what happened. Once the dam breaks in Afghanistan, there's no reforming a defense line. Historically, once momentum shifts, that momentum shift is permanent and irreversible. But I think it goes back to this question of legitimacy. Men have to believe, and women now in the U.S. forces, of course, have to believe that what they're fighting for is not just a just cause, but for a country and a government that they believe is there rightfully in office, and they're fighting for something that they believe in. The governments of Afghanistan, particularly the government of Ashraf Ghani, who had the support of perhaps 10% of the Afghan people, judged by the results of the last election in which less than 2 million people voted, and only about 800,000 of whom voted for Ashraf Ghani, at the end of the day, Afghan men were not willing to fight and die for the government of Ashraf Ghani.
I saw an interview last night with General David Petraeus, who was one of the former commanders in Afghanistan as well as in Iraq. He said that he came to the defense of Afghan fighters over the course of the war, said that many did fight, many did die. But he said the difference this time was they knew they had no backup, no airstrikes, no American reinforcements. What about that?
I think this would have happened much slower if the U.S. had remained in the position it was in, let's say, 5 years ago, with combat enablers, the ability to conduct airstrikes, to provide real-time intelligence to troops on the ground, maintenance contractors, the salaries of the Afghan soldiers, and so on. But just like in Vietnam, this was always going to happen. The other side had a better story. The U.S. could have stayed in Vietnam, in the position that we were in 1972, for another 10 years, and the outcome would have been the same. The North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong had more legitimacy. They had something that the people would believe in, where the South Vietnamese government and the government of Ashraf Ghani simply didn't have. The Taliban were mobilizing not just a religious narrative, but also a sort of a nationalist narrative, like, let's drive the colonists out, let's drive the foreign invaders out, and reunite our country and drive out the hated foreigners line of propaganda. And it was very effective. what happened in Afghanistan, we have to be clear, was always going to happen. President Biden was absolutely right. If we'd stayed another 6 months, another 5 years, another 10 years, this was still going to happen eventually, because there was just no there with the government of Afghanistan.
Amy, a listener, asked, said that you cut out, your audio cut out when making a parallel of the Taliban to a religious medieval group. What was that religious medieval group that you were making a comparison to?
Well, I think, you know, you can take the analogy too far, but I think there's some useful points of analogy to the Knights Templar during the time of the Crusades, sort of a religious warrior order that had priests and students and warriors, a class, an all-male society based on a religious core of beliefs, but which had a number of political interests as well. I think there are some similarities there.
How long has the Taliban existed? And Amy wanted to know that question as well. Answer that question.
You know, there is a scholarly debate about that, but the consensus is that the movement that today we call the Taliban probably originated sometime in the early 1990s, maybe 1991 or 1992. More commonly, you see attributions to 1994, 1995, but scholars of the Taliban believe the roots of the movement go all the way back to the end of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan before they left the country in 1989. So the movement is at least 30 years old anyway, and perhaps a bit older.
Something you said earlier, though, about the government of Afghanistan not having the support of the people. Obviously, the Taliban frightens. I think that's an understatement. There's people who just do not like the Taliban, are scared for their lives, frightened for their lives. So why would they support, why would the Taliban have a better story to tell than the Afghan government that basically was installed by the United States?
Well, we have to recognize that the people that we're talking to are the educated, primarily the educated urban Afghans in the cities like Kabul, Herat, Mazar-i-Sharif. But at least 80% of the population of Afghanistan, as was the case with South Vietnam, is rural. People who are living out in villages and hamlets far out in the countryside, who probably don't have even an elementary school education, they are deeply conservative, deeply religious, and they tend to believe what their local religious leader, their local mullah, tells them. And virtually all of those mullahs were supportive of the Taliban. So yes, there are certainly people in the cities of Afghanistan who are very concerned about the future, and I think rightly so. But a majority of Afghans live out in the countryside and are much more conservative than the people that we're seeing in the cities.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take more phone calls in just a moment, but along the lines of what you were just saying about the people in the rural areas, this is a quote from the Washington Post yesterday, and it was a quote from an American officer, said the biggest hardship was having to teach virtually every recruit. He's talking about Afghan recruits, was having to teach virtually every recruit how to read. It was estimated that only 2 to 5% of Afghan recruits could read at a third grade level, despite efforts by the U.S. to enroll millions of Afghan children in school over the previous decade. This officer said that the literacy was just insurmountable. Some Afghans also had to learn their colors, had to be taught how to count. He said, I mean, you could ask an Afghan soldier how many brothers and sisters they had, and they couldn't tell you it was four. They could tell you their names, but they couldn't go 1, 2, 3, 4. I mean, that's hard for us to imagine, but Was that your observation as well? I mean, this was a huge issue that these recruits, these Afghan recruits, just didn't have a basic education.
Well, yeah, I think that's absolutely true. Literacy was a tremendous problem in trying to build the Afghan army the way we tried to build it. But all of that is true of the Taliban soldiers and Taliban fighters as well. The Taliban didn't have an air force. You know, they didn't have drones. They didn't have the kind of modern communications that the Afghan National Army did. The Afghan army outnumbered the Taliban at least 2-1, as did the South Vietnamese army, outnumbered the North Vietnamese army at the end of the Vietnam War. So all of those disadvantages that officer talked about were true of the enemy as well, but they didn't prevent the enemy from fighting.
Let's take a phone call from Mark in Lancaster. Mark, you're on the air.
Hey, Scott, thanks for taking my call.
Yes, you're welcome.
Yeah, I would just like to say, it just seems like we never learn from the past. And, you know, if you go back to the founding of this nation, our founding fathers had a mantra, and that was avoid foreign entanglements. They're too costly in lives and money. And, you know, the sad part about it is prior to, you know, World War II and 1950, you couldn't drag the U.S. into a war. And now it seems like after 1950, the U.S. can't stay out of a war. You know, and I look at Dwight Eisenhower, the leading general of World War II and then president, in his farewell address to the nation, he said, you know, beware the military-industrial complex, for they will always find an enemy to fight. And that has been so true. And here it is, $2 trillion later, that we come to the conclusion it should have been ascertained, you know, in 2004. It's sad.
Thank you for your call, Mark. Dr. Mason, what about that? Are we getting are we too happy to get, and happy is not the right word, but willing to get involved in a foreign combat situation?
I think that's a very good point. I think the war in Afghanistan, by any dispassionate evaluation analysis, would justify terrorists.
Okay, I think we're going to have to call. We're going to have to call you back, Dr. Mason, on the telephone, because you're breaking up right now. We're going to take a break. Dr. Chris Mason, just to let you know, agreed to be with us yesterday with the breaking news, and he is on the road, pulled over to the side of the road, but on the telephone now. Dr. Chris Mason is professor of national security affairs at the Strategic Studies Institute at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle. We're talking about Afghanistan, the fall of Afghanistan. Let's take a phone call from Patrick in Mount Joy. Patrick, you're on the air.
Yes. Hello, Scott. Thank you for this program. It's my understanding that Afghanistan is the only country in Eurasia that was never colonized by England or France or any of the colonial powers, much because it's such a difficult place. And historically, nobody wanted to mess with it. Or if they tried, they got their, you know, they got their butts kicked. Your thoughts, Doctor?
Scott, should I just jump in?
Yeah,
sure. The gentleman has a very good point. Afghanistan is one of the few in the world that was created as a...
Okay, yeah. Obviously, we're having some issues with Dr. Mason and connecting with him. We'll try to get him back on... Oh, there you go. Go ahead.
It was basically the negative space between the Persian Empire, the Russian Empire, the British Empire, and the Chinese that sort of kept everyone apart and no one wanted.
Mm. A couple other factors I want to bring up, Dr. Mason. And this was former Secretary of Defense Gates brought this up. He said that, one of the issues that the United States faced in in Afghanistan was that we changed commanders fairly often. And each time a new commander would come in, they'd have a different idea on how to fight. Now, it wouldn't be, you know, starkly different, but that change of command always kind of the Afghan security forces didn't know, or the American forces for that matter, didn't know quite what was going on when a new commander would come in. What do you think?
Well, I mean, yeah, that's a good point. The frequent turnover of commanders and troops in Afghanistan did not provide the kind of continuity of experience and lessons learned that leaving troops and commanders in place for a longer period would have achieved. But again, I think that was kind of like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. It would not have changed the outcome. This outcome was going to occur independent of any U.S. military action. There is no military solution to this kind of internal rebellion. It's about national identity. It's about legitimacy of governance. And it's about the ability to protect the population from contact with the rebels. Afghanistan is a country four times the size of South Vietnam. There was no way that any military policy was going to turn around the basic political flaws in this country. I think the president was right about that yesterday.
Greg asks, if American politicians and military leaders with all their knowledge, sophisticated intelligence, and unlimited materials and equipment have failed so miserably again after having 20 years to figure it out, what can we say about their competence to handle any difficult future situations?
I think we have lessons that we need to learn from this. I think many of them are the same lessons we should have learned from the Vietnam War in terms of trying to change another country's culture, trying to create democracies where the people have no experience of that form of government, and trying to apply kinetic military solutions to fundamental political problems. I hope that we have some time after this all settles to reflect on this experience, and I hope that this time we learn the lessons that we should have learned from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. And this is one of the issues that many people have been bringing up over the last couple of days. What is America's place in the world right now? I mean, we've heard that, again, a lot of this is from politicians that are blaming other people, but that this has hurt America's reputation worldwide, and that it shows that America can't be trusted, that they won't have other nations won't have confidence in the United States. Does this hurt America's place in the world?
I think there's some truth to that observation, but you know, this outcome doesn't rest squarely on America's shoulders. We had more than 30 NATO partners trying to help us in Afghanistan as well to resolve the kind of structural problems that eventually brought the Afghan government down. The regional countries, Pakistan, Iran, Russia, also played a very unhelpful role in Afghanistan. The way this ended is unfortunate, this does cause countries in the region. I've seen news reports of countries now expressing concern and doubts about U.S. reliability in the region. I think that's inevitable, that leaders of other countries will look at this 20-year period and make evaluations and come to conclusions on their own. At the end of the day, I think the president was right. It was up to the Afghan people to fight for their own country. I honestly think that the generations of American servicemen and servicewomen who went there
did the best they could in incredibly difficult situations with incredibly complex problems. I think we bought the Afghans 20 years to modernize their country and sort out the divisions that stressed that society so dramatically. I think the president's decision ultimately was right. I think the way the withdrawal was handled certainly was not optimal. But I think, you know, there are bigger factors in play in the Pacific region today than just the Taliban taking over control of Afghanistan.
Is there potential for this to spill over into other nations in the region?
I don't think so. The Taliban have always said that they have no interest in anything that goes on outside Afghanistan, and I think that's true. During the time that they were in power, from 1996 to 2001, they did nothing to export Taliban control over any of the regional countries' territory, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Iran, and so on. They're a very insular, hermetic kind of worldview, and I don't think that there will be a spillover effect from the Taliban into the regional powers. There will be, I think, significant changes in the region driven by the other regional powers like China now seeking to fill the economic vacuum that U.S. withdrawal creates.
Yeah, that's something that hasn't gotten a lot of attention over the last couple of days. Not just China, but Russia as well. Both have indicated a willingness to recognize the government of the Taliban. China's influence worldwide continues to grow. And, with a government that isn't friendly to the United States. Let's take another phone call. This one from AJ in Carlisle. AJ, you're on the air.
Hi, yeah, thanks for taking my call. I agree with Biden and your guest speaker today that it was a war we were never going to win. But my question today is more about what lesson America really needs to take from our involvement over there, as far as you mentioned the fact that we have conservatives that are out in rural areas and more liberal people live in the cities, and that's not all that different from our current dynamic here in the United States. And we have some unrest on both sides, which has creeped into our government, and we are a nation divided, maybe not as extreme as Taliban and Afghanistan, but what lesson can we take from that and learn that if we don't soon bring our nation together, that we could in 10 or 15 years have civil war domestically, because we're not learning lessons from the fact that we are a divided nation.
AJ, thank you very much for your call. I think that there would be many people, Dr. Mason, who would think that something like this could never happen in the United States. But I think our point is that we do have a divided nation. I would say not ready to take up arms, but then you have January 6th. It doesn't help that we have a divided nation when we're talking about an issue like Afghanistan.
Well, I'm not really qualified to comment on domestic politics, but I think the caller has a point about national identity and making sure that we maintain a sense of our identity as Americans first. But you can't draw a comparison between Afghanistan an Afghan society and the United States an American society. The United States is a mature democracy. We've had constitutional democracy for well over 200 years. We have a very high level of national literacy. We have all of the building blocks here in the United States in terms of rule of law, trust in our neighbors, a high literacy level that make a democracy possible. A democracy can't be applied to a foreign country like a coat of paint. And we should learn the lesson, I hope, from Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan, that democracy cannot be installed in another country on the point of American bayonets. Democracy takes decades, if not longer, half a century perhaps, to take root. And it requires certain social building blocks, the building blocks of fundamental trust in your neighbor, the sense that the outcome will be fair, the sense that you're protected by the law from the depredations of criminal elements and so on. And none of those building blocks are present in Afghanistan. They arguably were not present in Vietnam. They certainly were not present in Iraq. I get the caller's point that there's, that we need to be aware of that. But the United States is not Afghanistan. Unfortunately, Afghanistan is just nowhere near the level of social capital that would allow democracy to work in that country. The term nation building is an oxymoron. Nations aren't built. They grow over years, centuries, almost geological time, like stalagmites or stalactites, and they don't come together in the space of 10 years or 20 years. It takes much, much longer for a sense of national identity to come together, and it hasn't in Afghanistan in the past 100 years, and I don't think it will anytime soon.
Let's take a call from Mary in Camp Hill. Mary, you're on Smart Talk.
Hi. I was living at Fort Bragg, North Carolina during the Vietnam War. When my dad was deployed, we would go back to California. But after the Vietnam War, there was an uproar about the Mountain Yards that were helping the special forces. And they wanted to bring a bunch of them in, and they did. But in the end, do you know how many interpreters, Army, wind up in the United States? Do you know, by any chance?
Yeah, you cut out a little bit there, Mary, but I think she's looking for, how many Afghans helped American forces and the coalition forces and could possibly maybe seek refuge here in the United States?
Yeah, I think that the actual number, we're trying to sort that out on the ground now in Afghanistan. The number of folks that aided us in Afghanistan and believed in what we were doing and helped us in the war effort there absolutely have to be protected. We have a debt to those people. How many there are, it's difficult to say. I've heard numbers from between 20,000 and 50,000. Other countries as well are evacuating Afghans who may be at risk from supporting the Afghan government through their embassies. Countries like England, Australia, Germany, France, and others are taking in refugees who may be at risk if they stay in Afghanistan. But I believe we absolutely have a debt to those people. To protect them, to relocate them, to keep them safe. I think we failed to do that after the Vietnam War. The way that we evacuated Vietnam left many hundreds of thousands of South Vietnamese at risk of retaliation and retribution. Many of them spent up to 20 years in what were called re-education camps. The most senior South Vietnamese generals, some of them were kept in what amounted to political prisons for up to 20 years. And we had a debt, I think, to those people that we didn't pay. And I hope we don't repeat that mistake in Afghanistan.
I have the sense that the Taliban won't resort to re-education camps, but rather they'll make it much quicker for those people that they think aided the United States. Is there any reason to believe this is a different Taliban than 20 years ago? And one of the reasons I ask that is because women especially are in danger of going back to being non-citizens, you know, under the Taliban again.
I think there's absolutely a terrible risk of that. I saw for the last couple of years people referring to Taliban 2.0 and a newer, more moderate Taliban. From the one that was in power in 2001 at the time of the September 11th attacks. And I don't think that's true. I think if there's any moderation in the Taliban, it remains to be seen, but I suspect it will be very small. I've already seen reports of young women being barred from going to university classes. I suspect that the misogynist views of the Taliban are largely unchanged from 2001. There might be some cosmetic differences. They may see the economic value of more international aid and contact with the West. But frankly, I think they're going to get that from China and from Russia. Because those countries are interested in the natural resources there, and I don't think Russia or China really has much concern for human rights in Afghanistan, so long as they, get what they want economically. So yes, I'm very concerned about that, and I don't think the Taliban have changed much or moderated their views much. Time will tell. We can hope. But I think, this, unfortunately, there's going to be a very difficult decade ahead, and I think many people who want a better life are going to try to get out of Afghanistan and move somewhere else.
Dr. Chris Mason is a professor of national security affairs at U.S. Army War College in Carlisle Strategic Studies Institute. Thank you for being with us today, Dr. Mason, taking time out of your day and your trip to be with us today. I think it provides a better understanding of what's happened.
Thank you for the discussion. I'm glad to come back anytime.
All right. Thank you. I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.